All right, buckle up, our fans,
Yeah.
because today we're diving headfirst into a masterpiece that's practically bursting at the seams with symbolism.
Oh, yeah.
We're going all the way to the Prado Museum in Madrid to unpack Giovanni Battista Tiepolo's The Immaculate Conception.
That's a great one. I love that painting.
This painting's got more travel stamps than a seasoned flight attendant.
It does, and like a seasoned flight attendant, it's got stories to tell.
From a church to a convent, and finally winding up in one of the most famous art museums on the planet, this painting has truly seen it all.
Right.
But before we get to its wild ride through history, can we get on the same page about what the Immaculate Conception actually means? I mean, I know it's Mary, but...
Oh, yeah, of course, of course. So it's a really important idea in Catholic theology. It's the belief that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was conceived without original sin.
Okay, so no Garden of Eden baggage for her.
Exactly.
But Tiepolo wasn't just painting, you know, a theological Wikipedia page here.
Right.
He was creating this piece for a very specific audience.
That's right. This was commissioned by King Charles III of Spain. He was a big art lover, and this altarpiece was originally meant for a church in Aranjuez.
Oh, wow.
Which is a royal town just outside of Madrid.
Fancy.
And Tiepolo, being the master that he was, used every trick in the Baroque style to really make sure that this painting had an emotional impact.
You know, even in pictures, just the size of this thing, it's awe-inspiring. You can just tell it was made to make you feel small.
Yeah.
Compared to the divine.
Yeah.
But how did Tiepolo actually, I mean, how did he go about depicting Mary in a way that just screams Immaculate Conception?
He uses a lot of traditional Christian iconography. For example, look at that serpent being crushed under Mary's feet.
Oh, yeah, that snake's toes.
What do you think Tiepolo is trying to say about Mary's power there?
I think he's really highlighting her triumph over sin, right? Like that snake represents temptation, the fall of man, and it's completely powerless against her.
Yeah.
And then you've got her standing on that crescent moon.
Right. We see that a lot with Mary. Is there more to that than I realize?
There is, absolutely. So on one level, it symbolizes chastity. The Roman goddess Diana is often associated with the crescent moon.
Uh-huh.
But Tiepolo is also playing with a deeper idea here. So just as the moon reflects the sun's light, Mary's grace is seen as a reflection of Christ's.
So it's like he's elevating her to this almost divine level, mirroring Jesus. Pretty clever.
And speaking of clever symbolism, we can't forget about the classics here, the dove and the stars.
Of course, yeah. So that dove hovering right above her represents the Holy Spirit, kind of that constant, you know, guiding presence in her life. And then the stars around her head, well, that connects her to the woman of the apocalypse.
Oh, right.
Which is this mysterious, powerful figure from the book of Revelation. She's often interpreted as, you know, a symbol of the church, and then that extends to Mary's role within the church.
It's amazing. He's like pulling together all these different threads of biblical imagery. It really is like a visual puzzle for, you know, the devout observer to unpack. And speaking of unpacking, can we talk about those flowers for a minute? We've got lilies, which I'm guessing symbolize purity, right?
But you got it. Lilies are a classic symbol of purity and innocence, you know, often linked with the Virgin Mary. But then Tiepolo takes it a step further. He adds in some roses.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And roses have a bunch of meanings.
They really are like the overachievers of the flower world.
That's one way to put it. But they symbolize love, virginity, and they even represent Mary as the queen of heaven.
Okay, so triple threat. Got it. And, you know, I'm seeing even more details here. What about that obelisk? It seems a little out of place.
That obelisk is there for a reason. It's a symbol of, you know, impregnable virginity, purity.
Really?
Tiepolo was a master of, like, layering these different symbols to create this, you know, richer, more complex narrative.
So you've got snakes, moons, flowers, even obelisks, and it's all coming together to tell Mary's story. That's incredible how he fits all that into one image.
Mm.
But I'm also seeing a palm branch, even a serpent holding an apple. What's the story with those? I feel like those belong in a different painting.
They might seem a little out of place at first, but they're really important to understanding the whole picture. For example, the palm branch, it means victory, exaltation. It reminds us of Mary's ultimate triumph, not just over sin, but over death itself.
So it's about more than just being conceived without original sin. It's about the bigger picture of salvation.
Exactly.
But that mirror, I don't know, it almost feels a little like a vanity item in this context.
No, not at all. The mirror, just like the lilies, is another symbol for Mary's purity. It also speaks to this idea that was super important in 18th century art and culture. This idea that female virtue was like deeply tied to appearances, you know, and chastity.
So Tiepolo wasn't just painting for the church. He was painting for a society really obsessed with these ideas about women and how they should look.
Yes, and it makes you think about how much his art was reflecting, maybe even challenging, you know, those societal anxieties.
Exactly.
And then you've got that serpent with the apple. That's a clear reference to the Garden of Eden, you know, the temptation of Adam and Eve.
Right.
By including it here, Tiepolo is really, you know, hitting home the point that Mary, unlike Eve and everyone else, wasn't touched by original sin.
It's like he's creating this, like, visual debate, contrasting Mary's purity with, you know, the fall of man.
Mm.
It's really interesting how he uses these symbols we all recognize to start a deeper conversation about theology. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, we can't forget this painting was meant for a very specific audience, the Alcantarine Franciscan order.
Oh, right. I heard about that.
They were known for having an incredibly strict interpretation of religious life.
So Tiepolo toned down his usual, flamboyant style to, like, appease them.
It's not that simple. Right. This version of the Immaculate Conception is definitely more majestic, more serious than an earlier version he painted, actually.
He did another Immaculate Conception.
He did, back in 1734. It's in a museum in Vicenza, Italy.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it's really interesting to compare the two. The 1734 version shows Mary as much younger, almost fragile looking. But this one, you know, the one for King Charles, it's much grander, more, how do you say, imposing.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. I can see how that would resonate with a stricter order. But it also makes you think about how Tiepolo's style changed over time.
Exactly. And to really understand those changes, we need to look at these five preliminary sketches he made for the altarpiece. They're at the Courtauld Institute of Art in London.
Okay, so we're talking about his early drafts, a behind-the-scenes peek into how he worked.
Exactly. And one sketch in particular is really interesting. It shows a really strong, muscular angel. It's probably the Archangel Michael, and he's, like, supporting Mary.
Archangel Michael. The one who defeats Lucifer. That's kind of a powerful image to include, especially, you know, for these guys.
It is. And it makes you think that Tiepolo maybe initially wanted to really emphasize, you know, the whole battle against evil.
That's fascinating. Why do you think he changed it? Was he told to cool it? Or did he just decide to, like, focus more on Mary and her own victory, you know?
That's a great question. To understand that, I think we have to look at another one of Tiepolo's Immaculate Conception sketches. This one's in the National Gallery of Ireland, and just like in that other sketch, Archangel Michael's front and center in this one too. So, like, why include him in some and not others?
Yeah, it's like he's sending mixed messages.
Right.
Was he trying to please the church, or was he, like, making a bigger point by going against their expectations? I'm interested to know what you think.
It's a real head-scratcher, but I think when we look at these different versions, we see that Tiepolo isn't just some skilled painter. You know, he's thinking about this stuff deeply. He's wrestling with religious doctrine, artistic freedom, and what his patrons want from him. He's a complex guy.
It's like we're piecing together the secret code, using his art to understand, you know, the man behind the breaststrokes.
Exactly.
And that's what makes, you know, these deep dives so much fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is just the beginning.
It's like we're piecing together a puzzle, trying to understand what he was really going for.
Right. It's like a good art historical mystery.
Totally. And speaking of mysteries, can we get back to that crescent moon for a second?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm still stuck on that whole thing with the moon and the sun and Mary and Jesus, you know.
It's a powerful image.
It is.
And, you know, there's actually even more to it than that. We were talking about how the crescent moon makes us think of Diana, the Roman goddess.
Right.
Well, yeah. Diana was also seen as, like, a protector of virginity. So back then, people were really worried about female sexuality and virtue and stuff like that.
Oh, for sure.
By connecting Mary with Diana, Tiepolo is kind of subtly, you know, reinforcing this image of her as the ultimate symbol of being pure and chaste.
So it's not just about religion. It's about how society saw women back then.
Exactly.
It makes you wonder if he was trying to say something about that too, you know?
I think so, yeah.
And all those little details that you start to see how clever Tiepolo really was.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't just some, like, you know, paint-by-numbers guy.
Oh, absolutely not. This guy was a master.
Yeah. He was plugged into what was going on around him, and it shows up in his work.
He was a social commentator.
Totally. It's like he's inviting us to look deeper, to question what we think we know about, like, how women were supposed to be back then, and how we see religious figures. And, you know, while we're looking deeper, have you noticed how he uses light in this painting?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, Mary is practically glowing.
Well, Tiepolo, like a lot of Baroque artists, was a master of using light and shadow.
For real.
It's how he created drama and made his work so powerful emotionally.
He's like the, the Spielberg of 18th century painting.
Like that. And speaking of storytelling, notice how he uses tenebrism.
Tenebrism, that's where things get all shadowy,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Like Caravaggio.
Yes, Caravaggio was all about tenebrism. And even though Tiepolo uses it in a more subtle way in The Immaculate Conception, it still gives the painting that sense of drama, you know, that feeling of importance.
Like you're watching a play or something.
Exactly. That's what he wanted. He wanted to pull you into that moment, make you feel awe and wonder.
Pretty amazing how he did all that with just like paint.
Yeah, well, he was a genius.
But it's easy to miss all that if you don't know what to look for.
That's why we do this. We're giving you the tools to like crack the code of art.
To help people understand it on a deeper level.
Exactly.
Because art isn't just about pretty pictures on the wall, right?
Right. It makes you think, challenges you to see things in a new way.
Exactly. It gets a conversation going.
That's a great way to put it.
And speaking of conversations, this whole thing has me thinking about what you said earlier about how artistic styles and even what people believe change over time.
Yeah, it's pretty wild when you think about it.
It's kind of intimidating, you know? How are we supposed to keep up with centuries of changing tastes? That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think it's about keeping up, really.
Yeah.
I think it's more about seeing art history as this, like, ongoing conversation.
Oh, interesting.
Not a set of rules. Like, Tiepolo was working during the Baroque period, right?
Right.
Well, that was a time when the Catholic Church was, like, doubling down on its teachings because of the whole Protestant Reformation thing.
Oh, right, the Counter-Reformation.
Exactly. And so artists like Tiepolo, they were, like, visual storytellers for the church.
Wow.
They had to create art that reinforced those Catholic teachings.
Wow, that's a lot of pressure.
I know, right? So if we want to understand their work, we have to understand that historical context.
That makes sense.
It's like trying to get a joke, but you don't know anything about the culture it came from.
Yeah, we just fall flat.
Exactly. So as you keep exploring art, try to learn about the history and culture that shaped it.
Because it's all connected.
Exactly. It's like unlocking these hidden layers of meaning you wouldn't believe.
I love that. It's like art history is one giant puzzle, and we just need to find the right clues.
Huh. I like that. And sometimes those clues come from the most unexpected places.
You know, I'm still thinking about those sketches, the Modelli.
Oh, yeah.
That whole Archangel Michael thing. I just can't let it go.
What about it?
Why include him in some versions and not others? It seems so deliberate, you know, like he was trying to subtly say, this is how I see it, take it or leave it.
Yeah, you might be onto something there.
It makes me wonder if he was a bit of a rebel, you know, pushing the boundaries of what was acceptable.
You know, it wouldn't be the first time an artist did that.
Right. It's like he's saying, I'm here for the job, but I'm also going to sneak in my own ideas.
That's a great way to put it.
I wonder how his patrons felt about that.
I mean, who knows? Unfortunately, we don't have all the answers, but that's part of what makes studying art history so fun.
It's true.
We're always trying to put the pieces together, understand what these artists were thinking, what they wanted to achieve.
It's like we're having a conversation with them through their art.
Yes. We're debating their ideas, uncovering what they really meant.
And we're doing it centuries later.
Exactly. And speaking of time, I can't help but think about this painting's own journey, you know?
Right. It started in a church, hung out in a convent for a while, and then bam, it's in the Prado.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder how its meaning might have changed along the way.
Totally. Did people see it differently when it was in a church versus a museum, you know?
Right. Those are great questions.
I know, right?
To figure that out, I think we have to remember that how we understand art isn't just about what the artist meant. It's also about how we're looking at it.
It's like this painting's been on tour.
It really has. And, you know, it makes you realize that art isn't static.
No, it's always changing, depending on who's looking at it.
Exactly. But before we get too deep into that, I wanted to give our listeners a little Tiepolo-inspired travel recommendation.
Oh, I love those. Where are we going?
If you're ever craving more Tiepolo after you've seen his Immaculate Conception, head over to Würzburg, Germany.
Würzburg, Germany. All right, I'm listening. What's in Würzburg?
The Würzburg Residence.
Okay, I've heard of that.
It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Fancy.
And Tiepolo, along with his son, Giovanni Domenico, they did these amazing frescoes there.
Oh, hold on. Frescoes.
Yeah.
We're talking serious art dedication here.
We are. These weren't just any frescoes.
Yeah.
They covered a huge area.
How huge are we talking?
677 square meters of the Würzburg Residence.
I don't even think I can picture that.
It's like covering an entire football field with Tupelo's art.
You're kidding. What kind of scenes did he paint for this massive project?
All sorts of things. You've got the marriage of Frederick Barbarossa to Beatrice of Burgundy.
Who are they?
Oh, just the Holy Roman Emperor and his bride.
Oh, right. Casual.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then you've got Apollo's chariot, you know, racing across the sky.
Risky.
And there are all these allegorical figures representing the continents, and they're all mixed in with everything else.
Wow, it sounds incredible.
It really is something else.
It's like he put everything he knew into those frescoes.
I think he did.
The scale, the detail. I bet it's an amazing experience to see them in person.
There's nothing like it. To stand there and look up at that, it's like you're in a different world.
Wow.
But even if you can't make it to Europe anytime soon...
There's always the internet.
Exactly. Both the Prado and the Würzburg residents have great websites with high-resolution images.
Love that. We always tell our listeners to do their own deep dives.
It's the best way to learn.
But before we wrap up our Tiepolo deep dive, I wanted to touch on one more thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier how, like, we all see art through our own lens.
Oh, right, right. That's so important to remember.
It's like that saying, you never step in the same river twice, right?
Exactly. Every time we look at a piece of art, we bring our own baggage, so to speak.
Our experiences, our beliefs, all of it.
And it all shapes how we understand what we're seeing, even if we don't realize it.
So what you're saying is there's no right or wrong answer when it comes to interpreting art.
Pretty much. It's more about having the conversation.
I love that.
It's a conversation that continues across time and cultures.
That's a great note to end on.
It is, isn't it?
Well, on that note, it looks like we've reached the end of our deep dive.
Already.
I know. Time flies.
It really does.
A huge thank you to you. This was amazing.
It was my pleasure.
And to our listeners, as always, thank you for listening. Keep exploring, keep asking questions, and we'll catch you on our next episode.